Hi, this is Alan Chartok, delighted because today is one of my favorite people to talk to, Maggie Massanelli Cahill, director and producing artistic director for Capitol Repertory Theater in Albany, New York. She is in her 20th season. Hard to believe she doesn't even look 20. And with her is a staff of thousands. No, but I can tell you one thing that is really going to happen here, and that is that we're going to have a little reunion, Maggie, because you've done such a fabulous job with your theater.
Thank you so much, Alan. Thank you. And you know, this is a time when I am really glad we're on the radio because of that crack about I look only 20. That's why I love you. That's why I will always come for you.
You mean you don't look like you're 20?
Yes, I do.
You're just about 20. You know,
of course.
I mean, you're a child. We've known each other for a number of years now, and I've interviewed you many, many times.
Yes.
And I just think you have an extraordinary ability to run your theater and to make good decisions. One of your decisions is the recent merger, which we've talked about in the past with Proctor's. Tell me how that's all working and how that came about.
Well, you know, I think one of the things about Capitol Rep is that we have reinvented ourselves many times over 35 years. We've been around for 35 years. And if we didn't have that capacity to reinvent ourselves, I'm not sure that we would be here. Albany is a small, relatively small city and metropolitan area. And to put a professional theater in the midst of our region is hard. So a few years ago, after 2008, when the economy really tanked, we were fine in 2008, but starting in 2009, 2010, we really saw how the ravages of the stock market to fall off impacted foundations, it impacted individual giving, and it impacted people's discretionary spending. And so we had to do something. So Philip Morris and I had been pals for years, and we really shared a vision of wanting to do regional theater, a true regional theater, and we really shared values about education
in the arts. And we should point out that Philip Morris is at Proctor's. He's the head guy.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Okay. And so we got together, and it took us a couple of tries to do it, and we said, what would happen if we got together, because we would be able to share some administrative staff and cut expenses without cutting quality. And that's what happened. And it has really, really paid off. It's been a wonderful relationship.
Now, don't get me wrong. I love Philip Morris. But, you know, usually there's something called the iron law of oligarchy. Somebody's got to be the chief. Is it shared, or have you had to give up certain kinds of decision-making powers?
Well, I mean, Philip is the CEO of Proctor's, and Proctor's is a huge organization that incorporates a power plant, a new project up in Saratoga Springs at Universal Preservation Hall, and Capitol Rep is on that string along with, you know, a media and a group and a lot of things. And so Philip's my boss. I call him boss. Hey, boss.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
Because he's a good guy, and I like his vision. And, of course, if he wanted me to do a play that he liked that I didn't like,
yeah,
we'd have to have a very strong talk about that.
There might be a talk. You know, I've been in your theater a number of times. I've seen some wonderful things there. My question is, it's smallish, and it's intimate. How can you make money in a smallish, intimate place?
Well, you know, a place like Proctor's has almost 3,000 seats in it.
Right.
Capitol Rep has about 300
right.
seats in it.
Sure.
But when we do a play, we do it for about between 35 and 45 performances. So we do many performances over time as opposed to doing a play for one or two nights. And so it's really, you have to amortize all your costs over that kind of thing. However, let me just say, we do not make money on ticket sales. We are not for profit resident theater company, and we're not set up like that. So we have to have strong ticket sales, and we have to have loyal donors. And our donors make up about 50% of our operating budget every year.
Wow.
Because they want professional theater in the Capital Region. And that's how resident companies work throughout the United States.
What's the most money anybody's ever given you?
Seriously? You want me to answer that?
Yeah, seriously.
Well, we've had some real help from the state of New York on a couple of capital projects that we've done in six figures.
Right.
And
I'm talking about individuals.
An individual?
Yeah, sitting in their living room.
Okay.
Listening to this.
I am not going to say who it is, but I'm going to tell you that I have on my hand five names that have consistently given six-figure gifts to the theater over the course of years. And I am very grateful to all of those people. Each and every one of them has a special place in my heart. I will never forget them. And if they ever needed anything, I would do it for them.
Oh, that's great. Where were you raised?
Well, you know, I'm an Army brat.
Are you?
Yeah. And so I moved to 19 different places before I was 14 years old.
Wow.
And but when I was 14, my father got quite ill, and we ended up in Denver, Colorado. So I do consider Denver my home. Yes, he did. Yeah, he was 43 years old.
Wow. Yeah. Did that make a permanent impact on your life?
Yes, it did.
How so?
I like older men.
Oh, is that what it is?
That's what it is, Alan. No.
So you're always looking for your father?
You know, it wouldn't be a bad thing, but no. I think that what it really did for me is it bonded me with my mother.
Uh-huh.
And I had a very strong connection with my mother until the day she died.
And how long ago was that?
That was in 2000. She passed away, and she was 73. And I think that because of my father's death, everything spun in a very different direction than I thought. I was such a daddy's girl. I really was. And it took me a while to create that relationship with my mother. And I think it was one of the most significant parts of growth in me as a person, is creating that relationship with my mother.
Yeah.
I do.
And then you got to high school and then college?
Yeah, college. I went to Colorado Women's College, and then I dropped out to go to acting school in New York for a couple of years, and then I came back and got my undergrad from the University of Colorado. And then
You majored in drama?
I did. I majored in theater, but in directing. I specialized in directing. And then I went off and I was a freelance director and founded a theater company for several years. And after 12 years, I went back to school and got an MFA from Columbia University in New York. And that's really what brought me to New York and finally, ultimately, to Capitol Rep.
Yeah. Tell me about directing.
What about it?
Well, I never know what they do, what directors do. And they say, stand here, look this way, kiss her harder. What do they do?
Well, that's it. Yeah, you got it. That's all we do. We tell them, move over here, move over there. Well, you know, the theater is divine chaos. It's a bunch of really smart people who have really strong ideas that all get together for a certain period of time to create something that we call a piece of art. And someone has to helm those really strong-minded, very creative, very smart people.
Crack the whip.
Well, you know, don't they say something about you attract more bees with honey?
Yeah.
You try that before the whip, for sure.
Are there actors who you just say, okay, this woman or this guy, I have to leave alone. They know what they're doing. I don't want to get on their case.
Yes, there are. And it's because they have a certain kind of process that you respect. And there are other times when you think, I'm going to leave him or her, she alone until they come to me. And actors want feedback. I mean, I think most people in life want feedback on the job they're doing. So ultimately, if you can stay open and not get your defenses up, that it has to be your way. You know, I think the gift of any director is, how many different kinds of people can you work with to create the whole?
I think I asked you this in a previous interview, but I'm going to ask you again. Have you ever had to fire anybody?
Yes, and it's terrible.
Tell me about it.
In 20 years that I've been at Capitol Rep, we have let two actors go. I mean, that's remarkable.
What would it take to get fired?
Well, one actor, I will say, had to make the choice to leave because his mother was gravely ill in Ireland. And so that was one, though. We had to let him go. And
what do you mean you had to let him go?
He didn't want to leave. And I felt...
Oh, I see.
He didn't want to leave. And I said, look, your mother is alive now. She was very, very sick. And I had to talk to him and convince him to leave. It wasn't because of the job he was doing. He was a wonderful actor. But I felt that in my capacity as a person, I needed to say, this play is not as important as you seeing your mother before she dies.
That's a nice story.
That is a nice story. But the other one, no, is not so nice. We had an actor who had a very, very difficult time saying the words that were actually in the play.
So give me an example.
Well,
I mean, you can't remember the words, but no. I'd love to be connected.
Let me put it this way. Yeah. I was following the script.
Yeah.
And I said, I wonder what play this person is doing because it's not the one we're rehearsing. And he had a very difficult time memorizing lines.
I've often wondered about that. I don't know how I can't remember my kids' names. How does anybody remember, you know, a 2 or 3 hour play?
You know, truly, it is a muscle that the actors have. And I think the same thing, Alan. I'm like, I'm so glad they're on the stage and not me.
Yeah.
Because the memorization, you know, to memorize 100 pages of dialogue, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? So we did have to let him go. It was a very hard decision. Very hard, but we had to do it.
How do you fire somebody? I've done it. I mean, how do you fire somebody?
Well, you know, we have a union, and there's a lot of technical things that you do, and then you try to be as kind as possible to really say, it can't work. If you don't say the right line, then we have other people who can't say their lines, and we can't do the play, and so we have to let you go.
Do you understand?
No, absolutely not.
Angry.
No, very angry, yes.
Mm. What's different about Albany than, for example, where I live in the Berkshires, where we have a lot of theater? Is there a difference in the way in which people think or who they are demographically,
well,
any other way?
You know me. I'm a real Albany and Capital Region booster. I love our area. I mean, I love Colorado, but when I came to New York and I came to the Hudson Mohawk Valley, I kind of fell in love with it. It's such a beautiful place, and it's easy to raise a family here. And a lot of people, I think, go away and come back to raise a family. And I was really enthralled to be able to raise my son here. I mean, that was such a draw for me in terms of other places that I have lived. And I've lived, as you know, in several states. But what I think is different about Albany is the audience is really smart, because of how close we are to New York City. So you are dealing with audiences who know Broadway theater. They know what's quality. They understand that. And they're going to compare what Capital Rep does to what they see in New York City. And so it raises the bar. I think it raises the bar in the Berkshires, too, by the way.
I'm
I think
sure.
That audience is very savvy. And I think we're very lucky because you are as good as your audience. And, you know, having an audience that understands that we're not like Broadway and that we're not a for-profit-making, you know, entity, and, you know, we need their help as well. But also to have a savvy audience who will go along with a new play they've never heard of, who will come to classic work, who will want us to deliver a play that was in New York for a little bit off-Broadway and they weren't able to see, it's kind of a luxury. I think we're very, very lucky to have that.
We're talking to Maggie Massanelli Cahill, who is one of my favorite people in the world and who is the director of the Albany Capital Rep, so we call it.
Well, yeah, I'm the producing artistic director. Yeah.
Maggie, I wanted to ask you, there is a problem that Tanglewood has, that theaters have in the Berkshires, that I see in other places. And as a 74-year-old, I think I can say this without fear of being, you know, contradicted, but there's a lot of gray hair in these theaters. Mm-hmm. How do we get kids re-excited about theater?
Well, you know, the subscriber audience for a resident theater like Capital Rep or like the Goodman or even Lincoln Center is part of our collective bargaining unit. That subscriber audience base has always been older. You know, there comes a point when you have time in your life when you can actually be a subscriber. What we had also, though, was a group of, well, let's say, 35 to 45-year-olds who were going to be that next wave. And that is where I look out and say, those are the people I want in our seats. So how do we get people who are 35 to 45, maybe their kids are growing up a little bit now, maybe they have a little bit more time. How can we make them frequent theater goers?
And the answer is?
The answer is you have to make them frequent theater goers when they're 13. And so, you know, I mean, I say this statistic all the time and people get tired of it, I'm sure, but I can't help it. If a child does not go to live theater before graduating from high school, 98% chance that child, that person, will never walk into a theater in their lives. So I feel like our education programs are critical to what we do. So we do a lot of them. We go out in schools with our on-the-go programs that are curriculum-specific works that use theater to expand lessons. And we have a lot of student matinees. We have student rates that are $16, which, you know, is less than you pay for a 3D movie now. So we make an effort to give kids the habit of walking into a theater and saying, hey, this is pretty good, you know. And it affects the plays that we do. It affects the work that we do in the schools. It affects the people I want to do the curtain speeches when we have young people in the house. It affects everything we do because I want them to feel like they belong there. And that's really key. I mean, last year we had almost 20,000 kids who went through our touring programs in the schools. And when you say we have 300 seats, but see, when we're without walls and we can go to a school and we play to the entire school, you know, out in some rural community that doesn't get theater, we see 1,000 kids. So we make a real effort. This is a very big commitment that we have at Capital Rep. And it is, by the way, highly supported by corporate sponsorships and individual donors. We have to have these programs subsidized because the schools don't have any money, you know, to be able to pay for, a top price on the arts. So we do everything we can to make sure the kids get these subsidized tickets and such.
Do you find that donors are attracted to this segment of what you do?
Yes. You know, I heard, by the way, I think I heard this on WAMC, I'm sure I did, that the SATs are changing how they're going to do vocabulary. And, you know, it used to be that list of vocabulary and you could you choose from A, B, C, D and, you know, you had a 1 in 4 chance that you might know the word, right? Now they're changing that and the vocabulary is going to be part of comprehensive reading. And for me, this is really critical that we start turning our education programs around and getting support for people understanding better and not having the multiple choice, but actually being able to understand what you say and what you write has meaning and impact. And I think the arts are critical, you know, to this idea, just critical. So I'm just feeling good about the fact that we can create better critical thinkers with the arts, and there are people who really want that to happen in our community who will support that idea.
What's your favorite? I know you're going to answer and say, well, I love all my children, but what is your favorite play that you've ever done?
Well, probably for me personally, it was an adaptation of a Dollhouse called Nora. Mm-hmm. And that was Ingmar Bergman's adaptation. I loved doing that play. It was very creative and it really packed a wallop for me.
Did you personally direct it?
I directed that one.
Yeah.
But of the plays I haven't directed, I would probably say 33 Variations. And that play was about a woman who was diagnosed with ALS and then was driven because she had had that diagnosis and she was under a deadline that she felt. And she was driven to find the creative source of the 33 Variations of Beethoven. And so Beethoven was in the play, and this woman with this incredible impending doom was in the play, and her daughter. And it was really a play about a mother-daughter relationship. So, of course, that's kind of play I love. Somebody from history, something that is very heartfelt, and a mother-daughter relationship. Come on. I mean, I love that play. Gordon Greenberg directed that, and I just love the whole thing. I thought it was one of our really, truly exceptional productions.
Now, we all know that all of us have to sort of balance things, you know. You might have one Ibsen play, but you may also want Mr. Roberts or, you know, I saw...
You're always throwing that in.
I saw that's right, one of my favorites of all time. By the way, he only wrote one thing. But then, you know, I just say that you have to be willing to say, okay, this one will challenge and this one they'll love.
That's right.
So how do you do that?
Well, every year... I used to read about 100 plays to come up with our season, but now we have a new act play festival, and with that alone, I read over 400 plays, plus the ones that I'm considering for the rest of our season. So I do a lot of reading, and I try to see a lot of plays in New York City. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I see play just because I think it would be fun, not because I'm trying not to have a busman's holiday, so to speak, in New York. But when I get it all together, I think exactly what you were talking about. This one would be fun. This one will have appeal to, you know, families. This one will be a little racier. I mean, in the holiday season, we did A Christmas Story, the musical, based on, you know, the movie about the kid who wants the BB gun. And Gene Shepherd, we love him. Yeah,
we do, and I listened every night. And this radio station, by the way, in its beginnings, played him.
Oh, really?
Yes, played WOR.
Oh my gosh! All those great stories.
A
great storyteller.
He was a genius.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, so go ahead.
So that was a musical, and we had kids from the community who were in our tap dancing ensemble, and they were wonderful. And then in January, we did a play called Naked Influence about an exotic dancer who, you know, is at a crisis point in her career. So I really...
So yeah. Full frontal nudity or not?
No, and there was, ironically in that, there was nudity in Nora, Dollhouse.
Yeah.
But in Naked Influence, the play about the exotic dancer, there was no nudity.
Well, do you have to sort of, I don't want to use a bad word here, do you have to excite your audience in a way that you did by taking that kind of chance? I know one director who allegedly in the Berkshires got fired because she showed nudity by the board of that theater. But times are changing. We're looking at different ways of doing things.
Well, you know, I'm very lucky because in the legacy of Capital Rep, I mean, Bruce Bouchard, who was the artistic director before me, he crossed that boundary with nudity before I got here. So, no, and this is what I mean about the audience, though. Very savvy audience. We've had a variety of plays that one might consider a little edgier. But, you know, and one of the plays that we did was called Take Me Out, which was about a baseball team, and they took showers on stage. I mean, we had to build 9 showers, and I know. And it was the full team, and it was the full Monty, so to speak. Yeah. And in Nora, I felt like because it called for female nudity of the character of Nora, that it was only fair for the male character to be nude. And I felt like that, dramatically speaking, not to woo an audience. Never done a play, you know, with nudity because I think that it would sell tickets ever. You don't pick a play because you think it's going to sell tickets. You do pick plays that you hope will appeal to your families and to people who want an edgier play and to people who will support new work and people who love classics. I mean, I hope for that, but I'm actually doing it because I think they'll love it, not because we're going to do this because I know it'll sell a lot of ticket sales. Because the minute you do that, guess what? That's all you got. You know, where's your integrity? Where's the underlying reason for doing it? Where's the artistic part of that, which is I really do believe art changes lives. So I got to stick to that. And I think that you have to create a balance of plays that will appeal to people and speak to them, and they'll come back because we all crave that.
Has a famous person ever walked into the theater that you didn't expect to see there?
Well, I'll tell you, John Kennedy Jr.
Really?
Yeah, he came to the premiere of Bill Kennedy's play, Grandview. And
did you know he was coming?
Not really.
Yeah.
And the day that he was coming, we were told this might happen. I never thought it would happen. I'm not kidding. I never thought it would happen. There was a lot of hoopla about that. And when he walked in, it turned out they had parked in our parking garage and got lost, which a lot of people do. And the parking attendant brought them into the theater. I thought that was just great. He was there with his then fiance. Then they just kind of walked in without any ceremony.
Did you talk to him?
Yes, he was very nice.
Did you get weak at the knees?
What?
Did you get weak at the knees?
He was very, very, very handsome. It's true. Yes,
yeah. It seems to me these actors and these leads and everybody have got to be a big turn on for a gorgeous woman like yourself.
Okay, I love the way you said that. I mean, that is so awesome. And I would just say that gorgeous, smart women like myself, right?
That's true. I stand corrected.
Well, let me put it this way. There have been times in my life when I think, gosh, and they pay me for this?
Yeah, I get that. I understand that. I feel the same way.
You meet a lot of wonderful people in your life, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Don't you sometimes wake up and just say, I'm lucky, I'm a lucky guy?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's a lot of stress. It takes a lot to keep our entities afloat.
There's always a lot of stress. What stresses you since you raised it?
What stresses me is I want our facility to be nicer, and so there's stress in how to get that done. I always want our patrons to have more heat in our bathrooms. That stresses me. I'm always trying to get the best actor I can, and sometimes I don't have enough money to pay them what they want, what they need. I want a star dressing room, which we don't have a Capital Rep. That stresses me if that's a deal breaker with somebody.
Do they get ticked off when they come? You know, they always have these riders. The agent always gives you a rider, how many grapes have to be in what color in the room there. So if you don't have a star's dressing room, where do you put them?
Well, let me tell you, that anybody who's ever come to Capital Rep has been extremely gracious.
You mean any actor?
Yeah, any actor, yeah. One of the most gracious actors that I ever met was Brian Dennehy.
No kidding.
And and he came and, you know, we showed him, we had cleared out one dressing room so it could just be his. He didn't even want to be in it. He sat in the green room with everybody and just told stories and asked about who they were and such.
Isn't that great?
He was a very, very generous guy and, you know, pretty big star to have an attitude like that. Leslie Uggams came and she was absolutely a joy. She needed to have water with lemons and that was it. That's all she really needed. So by the time people say yes to us, they kind of know the score. I've never had anybody get there and be really a pill.
Let's talk about critics for a minute. One of my favorite subjects, you know, those who can do, those who can't teach, those who can't teach or do become critics. So
you said that, not me.
No, of course you wouldn't want, for exactly that reason, you don't want them to get on your case. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, yes.
So a critic can really hurt you.
A critic's words can hurt you, yes.
Well,
that is true.
Yeah. So what do you think about that? I mean, do they have too much power? Because I know in the Berkshires, for example, we just have the Berkshire Eagle is the main paper.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other ancillary papers, but the Berkshire Eagle, the New York Times and the Boston Globe frequently extol a play, and then you may see a negative review in the Eagle. Well, in the old days, before the newspapers were in such bad shape, because I have a thesis here, this being a conversation between you and me, I know you want to hear it. And my thesis is, as the newspapers have become more and more a thing of the past, critics have been less and less likely to be mean.
Okay, that's your experience.
Yeah, not yours.
No, okay. That would not be my experience.
Okay.
But, you know, let's be clear, a critic is entitled to his or her opinion.
I don't think so.
Well, they are entitled to it. You don't have to agree with it.
You know, they're entitled to it, but it can have extreme economic consequences if they say this is a dog.
Yes, it can.
Do you ever pick up the phone and say, you know, you don't know Jack, beep, what are you talking about? Do you ever get angry at one of them?
That is two different questions, and
okay.
I will tell you, I have never picked up the phone and spoken to a critic and told them that I was unhappy or angry. I've never done that.
So what's the strategy? You get a bad review, what do you do?
Cry.
Yeah,
I mean, there are times when, you know, I know when we get a really great review because my phone will start buzzing next to my bedside.
Sure.
And when we get a stinker, the phone just lays there quiet. No one wants to really tell me. And there are times when I say, oh, this is the day when I just want to take the covers and hide my head. But the truth is that I like good reviews. I like positive reviews. I like constructive reviews better than negative reviews.
Have you ever, do you use social media at all to advance, Maggie, to advance your plays? As my mom would say, everybody's doing it now.
Well, we have incredible social media. one of the things that you asked me about our alliance with Proctors, and one of the things Proctors is really strong, is on social media. So sure, I mean, we do testimonials with people. Certainly, if we get a good review with a great quote, we tout it everywhere that we can. I mean, that part of our business hasn't changed a bit. I think social media is good for having people chime in. Like, I saw that. I didn't agree with that. Where was he? I was there that night, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
But I do think that ultimately the critic's word has influence. Why would we have critics on newspapers if their words didn't have influence? And so I think that every newspaper and every critic knows they have a responsibility. They are read, and what they say does matter. And I take that very seriously, very seriously. And I take it serious enough that if they say something bad, I do not confront them on it. It's a serious business we're in. I respect them. They respect me.
Well, that's a safe thing for you to say. I mean, in your own heart of hearts, you may really hate them. No, especially if they're a dummy.
You know, I'll tell you something. I know the critics in the Capital Region.
Yeah, sure.
And I think they would make excellent dinner companions. They're interesting. They see a lot of theater. I love theater. I hope they do. And I hope when they don't like it anymore, they quit.
Well, but they need to feed themselves. Why would they quit? Especially because they used to be doing bottom feeding.
Oh, I think that people like to like their jobs. I do.
Some do, some don't. I mean, you know, I was an academic for a lot of years. I see people who went into the academy, you know, guns blazing, were really great, and then sort of gave up, turned over the notes.
I think that's very sad.
Well, it may be sad, but it's so. Yeah. That's one of the
things. You know, I always really hope that critics are able to not go there and know that there are good things, know that there's value, know that what they say matters. You know, and I know I've had conversations with some of our staff people about this. You know, when cleverness is a part of a smack in the face, it bothers me. You bet. It bothers me. But, and I know that critics have to appeal to their readership. I know all about it. You know, I did live with a journalist for many years.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember.
So I know the score, and I respect it. But I don't always like it.
We're talking to Maggie Massanelli Cahill, Cap Rep. I guess I got to ask you, when you find the actors, you mentioned it before, what goes into the decision? Price? You like them? What is it that gets you to hire them?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize, but 95% of our actors on the Capital Rep stage come from New York City. And when they get a contract at Capital Rep, they live in an apartment in Albany that we furnish for them as part of our union agreement. And they come here and they live here for anywhere between 8 to 12 weeks. Wow. And they become a part of the fabric of downtown Albany. You know, they're in restaurants and they're, you know, they're eating their bagels and, you know, they're walking around and et cetera, et cetera.
Do they ever misbehave?
Never.
Okay. All right.
And of course not, Alan.
What I mean by that is you've got all of these young people, you know, who are interested in theater.
Yeah.
A lot of young people, particularly, you know, some of them are quite intelligent and good looking.
Yeah, that's right.
And here you got some of these people who come in, and these look like tempting projects for them. You know what I mean?
You mean being
hitting
in our...
As in hitting on them.
Oh, hitting on them. Oh, well, you know, hey, you know, our actors aren't going to tell me about that stuff, you know.
I'm the last to know. Baloney. There's nothing you don't know.
Well, I have been accused of having eyes in the back of my head. That is true. No, our actors, you know, they really do behave most of the time. And have we had some incidents? Uh-huh. Am I going to tell you? No, I'm not.
No,
Let me just stop that question right now.
No, you can't. You can never stop me. But so have you ever had to have a conversation?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I have.
And what happened?
And it was with a young, handsome, really smart actor, and I had to have a talk.
A talk.
And I had my best mom hat on that day.
And so there was never a question of, you can't talk to me this way?
Absolutely not. No.
Head down though.
I don't know, Alan, if you've noticed this, but there is a little privilege with age.
I have noticed that.
Okay. So when I
There used to be, but then I got so old that there was no privilege.
I don't believe that. So, you know, when I'm talking to somebody, I'm not, you know, they're gonna listen. Sure. I'm gonna listen to them too.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, I've had to have a couple talks, but not many. And I've been there a long time. But I was going to go back and say that these actors come from New York. They have Broadway credits, you know, all the way up their arms. They're really good at what they do. They're serious. They're serious artists. And we use a casting director in New York City. Her name is Stephanie Clapper. She has worked for Capital Rep for 23 years. And she knows the score. She knows our contract. She knows how much we can pay. She knows the amenities that we can give an actor. And so when we go there and we, you know, we say we're looking for 5 actors and here's the types and here's the descriptions of the characters that we're looking for. When we see actors at auditions, they're there because they like the idea of coming to Albany because it's close to New York City where they live.
Amtrak.
You know, that's right. And it's close to their families. They can get back and forth. They can go back to the city on Mondays, their day off, for auditions, you know, and they come because we're probably doing a play that has a great part in it. And so that attracts actors, you know. They want to do really good parts and for a company that will treat them well.
I love to read the bios, you know, the playbills.
Yes.
And inevitably, everybody has worked for Law and Order.
Yeah.
And that's very impressive, maybe not to everybody else, but to me, because Law and Order is the great. You know,
I love Law and Order. Yeah, you know, I'm a total junkie.
I've gotten to the point with them, to be honest with you, Maggie, that I can watch them and Roselle will be sitting next to me and I'll begin to tell her exactly what is happening and what the lines are. And it's astounding. So are there bona fides that will make people in the audience like me pick up their eyebrows and say, whoa, Law and Order, you know, I wonder if they knew Sam. And like that.
Yeah. I mean, we just had a guy in Naked Influence who would name Robert Newman, and he had been on a soap opera for 23 years, and he had oodles of fans who came out and saw him, and he was...
Because he had been on the
soap, sure.
Really?
And yeah, and he was extremely gracious with every fan and, you know, signed a lot of autographs while he was here, and it was wonderful to have him. And in the show that I mentioned, 33 Variations, we had 2 actors who have been Tony nominated at least once. Bob Stillman, who is an amazing performer and composer who's been nominated for Tonys, and Barbara Walsh, who was nominated for her performance in Company on Broadway. And, you know, you see these kind of credentials and these kind of pedigrees, and, you know, it's hard to get a part on Broadway. And to get a Tony nomination, that is a very big deal in our world. And so I feel very privileged to work with artists of that caliber here on our stage. And then when, you know, the audience comes and, you know, you're never more than 30 feet away. As you say, we only have, you know, 300 seats. So
It's very intimate. That's what I love about it.
You're 30 feet away. Yeah. We play on 3 sides. It's called a thrust theater. So, you know, we play on 3 sides. So you feel like, I think, in some of the performances we've had, that you know the people. And I think that that's a real asset.
Yeah.
I love that.
I saw a great thing there about Woody Guthrie.
Oh, yeah. Woody Guthrie's American Song.
That was fabulous.
Yes, it was. I love that show.
That was really fabulous.
Yeah, I love that show.
Yeah. So what about academics? You know, you went back to Columbia, a very prestigious place, and got a degree. And MFA, which is considered by most to be the terminal degree in the arts. Do you think that our colleges and universities are doing it right?
Doing it right?
Yeah, doing it right.
Well, I think there's some great programs out there. And I think there's some not-so-great programs out there.
So the ones like Iowa, which have this tremendous reputation.
For writing, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the best. It's one of the finest. You know, I will say it. I was really sad when SUNY Albany stopped their theater program and their language programs. I was very sad about that. Now, the truth is that they are ramping up again. And I'm delighted about that. And I'm going to tell you why I am. Because I need young people who are right out of college to come in and be apprentices and learn how to be craftsmen and artisans in the theater. And we were very hurt in the workforce development arena of what we do. And workforce development is a really important thing. Resident companies do it, and small companies like Capital Rep. You know, we bring young people in, we train them, backstage, we train them how to be stage managers, we train them how to work in a shop. And then, you know, they stay with us 2 or 3 years, and it's true, then they go off and get a better job. That's the deal. But we have had a dearth of people who were able to come in on those levels right out of college to learn how to do stuff that we can teach them.
Have you made that clear to the university?
Who do you want us to tell about that? Who should we tell?
The president.
The president. Well, you know, we were pretty vocal, at least with our colleagues that we knew at the time. And we're also vocal now to say, yes, we're happy that you're doing anything, that you're trying to rebuild, you know, that department. I know SUNY New Paltz, the very prestigious.
Actually SUNY at New Paltz, you know, I spent a good deal of time at both institutions the last 20 years or so at both. SUNY at New Paltz had a tremendous drama department.
They still do.
You never know what's going to catch on. When I got to SUNY at New Paltz in 1970, it was not supposed to do legislative politics, but we did it.
But you did
Jerry Benjamin and I did it, and we, the Legislative Gazette, and first internship program in the legislature, and all the rest of it. So you never know what's going to catch fire in one of these places.
Well, SUNY New Paltz is the focused area right now, certainly for theater arts, and they have a terrific program. And you know, we work with some of the designers there to
much better than Purchase, for example.
my son went to Purchase for 2 years, so
you have to know that you only went for 2 years.
Oh, I'm not going there with you. You know, he learned a lot, but I would like one of those. I would like a theater major in the Capital Region. You know, St. Rose doesn't have a theater major. Sage has a kind of a round, I think it's called creative arts major. But they do have a theater program. SUNY Albany dropped theirs and now is trying to rebuild theirs. Skidmore is too far away. And I want a theater major. I'd love to have an MFA program in the Capital Region. We have all of these colleges and institutions of higher learning, and we, you know, I would like to have a partnership. You know, we need workers. So Philip Morris again and I are committed to this, and we are trying to find a way where we can be a leader in building a place where people can come and learn about backstage and learn about being a theater artisan and learn how to work a soundboard and a light board and become very knowledgeable and learn what it is to be a professional in these areas. And I hope we can do it.
Beautiful people are often, and we kidded around about this before, or maybe not, and attracted to acting and to theater. For someone like myself who, you know, may be a little deficient in that area, one wonders whether or not...
There's a part for you and Mr. Rogers, Alan.
And Mr. Roberts.
Mr. Roberts.
Yeah, sure, yeah. That's one of the reasons it's so great.
Oh, is that the reason that you want everyone to produce it?
I could be like Pulver.
Oh, there you go.
Who, by the way, won the Academy Award for it, not Henry Fonda. I know everything there is to know about Mr. Roberts. I was at a dinner party not that long ago, not that you would be terribly interested in it, but there were some big shots there. And they were all very intellectual, and they were all very theater-oriented people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was a big, big table. And the host said, let's go around the table and talk about, you know, our favorite film ever. Uh-huh. And we went around the room, and the first guy said something like Seventh Seal or something like that, you know. And they went around the room, and they finally got to me, you know. And I thought The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance was just a great show. And everybody looked down at their plates, you know.
Oh.
Everybody just looked down at their plates, you know. So there is a certain amount of snottery that goes around in theater and other places that you have to ignore sometimes in order to bring things that will please people. Yes?
I don't think there's anything wrong with laughing. I do not think that a comedy is any lower than the best drama.
No, it's hard.
And it's hard. And
right?
I will tell you, as they say, comedy is hard, death is easy. You know, comedy is hard. I have a lot of respect for it. And
did you ever do A Thousand Clowns?
No, but I was in Thousand Clouds. It was the last thing I ever acted in, you know? So it was hard.
You unhappy that you're not doing more? Did you play the social worker? Who did you play?
Yes, I played the social worker. Yeah, of course.
So good that I could pick that up.
Yes, it is.
Right. So
it happens to be the only woman in the cast, but
correct.
Yes, I did play her.
So can you bring the? That's a good point. can you bring that here for me? You know, so that I can go again. You know, in which he names himself the name of our dog. Murray.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, is that where Murray was named?
No, Murray was named because there's a fabulous theater critic who lives in the Berkshires and in New York City, Deborah Jowett. And her husband is named Murray Ralph. And they have a son named Toby, who's a great drummer. And when we got our dog, Murray, or Westy, we asked, we said, okay, what are we going to name him? And Roselle said, let's name him Toby. I said, no, let's name him Toby's father, Murray, because I thought of a guy in Katz's Delicatessen eating a big pastrami sandwich and his little beautiful dog, you know, would be the right sort of dissonance for that. So that's how Murray got his name.
That's very sweet. Yeah. That's very, very sweet.
You have a dog?
I do.
What kind of dog?
She's a schnoodle.
A schnoodle?
Yes. So she's
half a schnauzer, half a poodle.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And her name is Emma.
Yeah, and how's that go?
How come
you got a girl dog as opposed to a boy dog?
You know, it was really the luck of the litter.
She
was the one that just caught my... Emma was my son's dog, and everybody thinks, oh, that's so sweet that you named her after a Jane Austen character.
Of course.
You know, but Emma was actually named after Eminem. My son named him, and it has really nothing to do with Jane Austen, but I accept now the Jane Austen, you know, reference because I want to be, you know, very posh and elite.
Of course, and my mother taught me that when somebody offers you a compliment, and you say, did you, I knew somebody who went to Harper College, and they said, did you say Harvard? And you say, never deny.
Yeah,
right. So how old is the dog now?
You know, she's 11.
No, that's getting there.
And she is, but she has promised never to die.
Yeah.
Everybody knows this about Emma. She has promised never to die.
Yeah.
My pal.
First of all, have you ever brought her to the theater itself?
I have, but Emma is not a theater dog. She turns her tail up and says, I don't want to deal with these people.
Yeah, no, I get it.
They don't pay enough attention to me.
Sounds like a smart dog.
She's a very smart dog.
Right.
No, I don't take her to the theater with me, but she is my pal, and really, life is better with a dog.
No question about that.
No question.
Yeah. So what do you want to do now? You've done so much. It's such a wonderful little theater, and you've performed so well. And what do you want to do now? What are you looking for?
Well, I really am looking to do some things. One is I want to make sure that I give some directors a shot who have, I think, paid their dues with our theater. Some younger people, I want to pave the way for them to be able to direct at Capitol Rep. And it's a big deal because mostly I use directors, you know, from New York City. And so for me to say this, it means that I feel that for my legacy, I have to groom some of the people who are on the staff, some of the people who have been from the area and have gone away and got themselves, you know, highly educated. And now they come back and they want to make a commitment to this area and on the professional theater. And so I have to pave the way to have that happen. I have to do that. I feel strongly that I would be wrong if I didn't.
We've talked about critics before.
Yeah.
But I take it you have a board.
Yes.
And do they ever say, I didn't like this, I like this?
Well, yeah, but I like to get the opinion of my board.
You do?
I do, because they go to theater.
They do.
And they go to theater all over. And so when they talk to me in a more serious way about what did I think about this or that, or they thought that this play worked here and not there, or why do you want to do that play? And then I go, you know, because I feel that I also, one of the things we didn't talk about, but I'm telling you that I feel that we have to have racial diversity in our season. And I think it's really critical. And I would go to the mat for that. But thank gosh, our board is totally on board with that. I mean, they totally support that and always have. For 35 years, our theater has been a hallmark of diversity.
And how do you do that? How do you achieve that? Are there enough people? Is there enough talent for you?
There's tons of talent.
And where do you get them from? Do you have to go to New York again, or can you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mix, because we don't have a lot of equity actors who live in our area, because there's not enough work to live here and be able to make a living. So, but it's a combination. We're doing Trip to Bountiful, and it has an African-American cast. Some of it will come from the area with equity actors who actually live here. I have parts for two non-equity actors in that play. And
how's
I just
that decided that you can have so many equity?
Oh, well, you know, we're part of a collective bargaining unit, and that's all laid out for us. So for our level of theater and our level of contract, we have to have this amount of equity actors, and then we can open it up.
How much does it cost them to be in equity? Do you know?
I don't. I don't know what the latest.
When I worked for Channel 13, they made me join the union.
They did?
It cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
I forget what it was like.
But look at the big bucks you made as a result.
Oh, boy.
You know.
Almost all of it went to the union. So you want to get more directors. What else you want to do?
I would like to beautify our building in downtown.
You've been talking about that for a long time.
I have been, but I've been really, really a nudge about it for the past 3 years.
Who do you nudge?
Years.
You nudge Philip Morris, or you nudge
Philip
your board?
Philip is working. Philip and the board, and we're all working on it. We're working on it with the mayor. We're working on it with our landlord.
Has she been good? Has the mayor been good to you?
You know? Yeah, the mayor supports the arts, and that's really what you want for a mayor.
Not so much up here, but that's okay. That's another story.
You know, the problem with Albany, of course, is that it's a capital city, and it doesn't have any money.
No.
And that is a problem for the arts. I wish we had some more support there, but it's such a bigger picture. But my other legacy is I want to create a real regional theater that cuts across all the barriers, that can operate as one entity and get people out of their mindsets that I live in this city, I can't cross that county line, that, you know. We are so close together compared to, like, the people in Los Angeles.
Sure.
Who they go to the grocery store and it's 45 minutes away. I think we're so lucky, and I would like to be a part of building that thing. And that's what I want to do.
Yeah. Will you be here forever?
You know what? You and I, we will be here forever, right?
Well, I've always said feet first. When are you leaving? Feet first.
If I got a couple things on my bucket list, I would just want to work less. You know, I'd like to be available to help people, especially young people. You know, I'd like to do a little bit of teaching, Ellen, and I would like to have less on my shoulders.
Yeah.
I just want time that other people aren't managing for me.
Well, don't do it.
Okay.
We've been talking with Maggie Massanelli Cahill, producing artistic director for Capitol Repertory Theater. And Maggie, I love you, and I hope that you'll keep coming back, because I love our conversations. So be here and promise me you'll do it.
I promise.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, president and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.